From the beginning, it was the year of the election. Everything pointed toward November 5th. But along the way, there were some major detours.
It's clear to me that my candidacy has not won the wide acceptance with rank-and-file Republicans that I had hoped to achieve.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
I want to tell the anarchist again that you've had your day because you are through after January of 1969.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop.
What has violence ever accomplished? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet.
I have done my best. I have lost. Mr. Nixon has won.
Having lost a close one 8 years ago and having won a close one this year, I can say this. Winning's a lot more fun.
I think it's positively fantastic to look out of the window out of the federal building, see all the black and the white hugging onto each other. I just wish this could go on and on forever.
The moon is essentially gray. No color. Looks like plaster of Paris.
In each year, there are tragedies and triumphs. 1968 was no exception. This electronic diary will document the happenings of 12 months, the good and the bad. For whatever occurs becomes history and is rightfully remembered, with joy or with sorrow. An incredible year ended with one of the most incredible stories of all time, the flight of Apollo 8. Colonel Frank Borman, Navy Captain James Lovell Jr., and Air Force Major William Anders took a 500,000-mile trip and literally became the first men to leave this world. They orbited the moon and were a mere 70 miles from the lunar surface when astronaut Lovell described what no man had ever seen.
The moon is essentially gray. No color. Looks like plaster of Paris. Or a sort of a grayish beach sand. We can see quite a bit of detail. The Sea of Fertility doesn't stand out as well here as it does back on Earth.
The astronauts spent Christmas Eve circling the moon, and on Christmas Day began their space voyage home, ending in a perfect splashdown in the Pacific. It was an all-American achievement, but the world shared the amazement, for it was truly something for all mankind. As the year began, politics was in the forefront. Michigan Governor Romney had entered the presidential race 3 months earlier, and in January he returned from a fact-finding tour of the Far East. His popularity was waning, and he knew it.
Well, if you rely on the polls and so on, why, obviously there's been a change. I don't question the hard realities. I'm a pretty realistic fellow. I try to be idealistic, too, but I'm a realistic idealist. And obviously, I face an uphill battle.
But the governor kept up the campaign. Then finally, just before the New Hampshire primary, he threw in the towel.
It's clear to me that my candidacy has not won the wide acceptance with rank-and-file Republicans that I had hoped to achieve. I've sought the presidency only because of my deep concern about the future of this country. I'm no less concerned now, but I have concluded that I can best serve my country and the ideas in which I believe other than as a candidate.
Returning to Michigan, the governor good-naturedly viewed his try for the top spot.
I don't think that I was quite the bumbling, inarticulate idiot that I was painted.
One less candidate didn't really change much. There was already an abundance.
Popular judgment was that we had to have a change of policy with reference to the war and also a new emphasis in dealing with our domestic problems.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
I pledge to you, we're going to have a new leadership that will make Americans proud of their leadership in Washington, proud of their country and not ashamed of it.
I frankly find that to comment from the sidelines is not an effective way to present the alternative.
On Sunday, March 31st, the nation took note of a primetime presidential address. It was, said the media, to be a major policy statement on Vietnam. They were right.
Tonight, I have offered the first in what I hope will be a series of mutual moves toward peace.
35 minutes into his speech, with America listening, many buoyed by a move toward peace, the president jolted the nation.
Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Suddenly, the American political scene changed completely. And then, 4 days after the president's move toward peace and his stated retirement, the nation's most ardent exponent of nonviolent social reform was violently silenced.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
Few Americans could match the oratory of Martin Luther King, Jr. When he spoke, he stirred souls. And no moment is better remembered than his 1963 address during the Washington Freedom March.
We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Dr. King was in Memphis in the spring, ostensibly to aid striking sanitation workers in wage demands. The garbage collector's plight seemed insignificant for the man who had conquered Montgomery, Birmingham, and Selma. And as it was with everything King had done, there was dark foreboding. On April 3rd, he spoke at a Memphis rally.
Then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop.
The next evening, as he stood on the balcony of a modest motel, one shot rang out, fired from a grimy lavatory in a seedy rooming house a mere 200 feet away. Within an hour, Martin Luther King was dead. The assassin escaped as his senseless deed touched off a wave of violence that shook the nation. The rioting broke out in Baltimore, Chicago, and Washington. By week's end, the world had the picture of Army machine gun emplacements on the Capitol steps. In Detroit, there were appeals for sanity.
I urge everyone to remain calm above all else in the interest of public peace, because really no more tragic consequence of Dr. King's murder could take place than if we were to be untrue to the dream about which he used to speak, which motivated this man's life, and that was of nonviolence.
Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh's fast action paid off. State officials also moved swiftly, and it worked. There was a curfew and other restrictions, but only a few minor incidents were reported. On April 9th, the body of Dr. Martin Luther King was borne through Atlanta streets on a mule-drawn wagon. 100,000 marched along. The great and the common paid their final respects to the man with a dream of a better world for all people. Politics was forgotten during a time of soul-searching. In Cleveland, a candidate who had seen assassination before kept a scheduled speaking engagement.
I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled. by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people.
In 2 months, Robert Francis Kennedy would himself die. The senator and presidential candidate was killed in a moment of triumph. He had won the California primary, his hardest-fought political battle. He made a short victory speech at the Los Angeles Ambassador Hotel, and to avoid the crowded ballroom left by a kitchen corridor. And once again, there was the sound of gunfire. And again, the long journey home, the lowered flags, the harrowed faces of a nation in grief. The pain was magnified by the sickening familiarity. The third U.S. leader to die at the hand of an assassin in less than 5 years. And two were Kennedys. A family that, despite the wealth and Camelot glamour, seemed star-crossed. At St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, the flag-draped coffin was viewed by thousands, and their grief was not hidden.
It took me close to 14 years to become an American citizen, and he was a big inspiration in it for me and my sister. I'm sorry.
A high requiem mass followed, and the eulogy came from the only remaining Kennedy brother.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today, pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Then a 21-car funeral train to Washington. A 226-mile trip taking 9 hours as hundreds of thousands line the route. And finally, the body of Robert Kennedy is placed in Arlington National Cemetery, just a few steps from the grave of his brother. The alleged assassin of Senator Kennedy, a 24-year-old Jordanian immigrant, Saran Bashara Saran. He was indicted for first-degree murder. The trial is yet to come. And ironically, on the day of the Kennedy funeral, word from London that James Earl Ray, wanted for the murder of Martin Luther King, had been apprehended. He too was indicted. He too awaits trial. A stunned and shocked nation asks why. Perhaps Detroit Episcopal Bishop Richard Emmerich was most succinct.
Why is it in this great land that with our cursed guns we cut down the best and the dearest that we have?
Americans suddenly began to forget the democratic process, the judicial system, the knack for organization and invention, and the affluence. Instead, there was a picture of a blood-drenched shooting gallery stretching across a continent. There were images of housewives taking pistol practice, toddlers getting toy guns as gifts and graduating to air rifles before their teens. There was the easy access of firearms to anyone with the necessary buying power. And there were the statistics. 6,500 murders a year by gun, 44,000 serious assaults, 50,000 armed robberies, and 100,000 non-fatal injuries. In Detroit, there was a recognized arms race, attributed by most to racial tension, and viewed with rightful concern by the officialdom. Early in the year, Mayor Kavanaugh addressed the area.
Citizens of Detroit, both Negro and white,
are arming themselves in unprecedented numbers, and in the suburbs surrounding Detroit, gun sales have also soared. And let me say, my fellow citizens, that this arms race must be stopped. We must return to sanity. The continuing spiral of gun purchases to people in this area is a most serious threat to the public safety and the maintenance of peace in our community.
A group of Detroit business and professional men formed what was known as MUST, Men United for Sane Thought. They designed and printed a series of posters. Kenneth Davies described a typical sign.
It shows, of course, as you can see, a body covered with a white blanket and a neighbor leaning over the body with a gun in his hand. And tragedies such as these will probably take place. The caption on this is, "Be the first on your block to shoot a neighbor."
The president appealed for more control.
Let us, for God's sake, resolve to live under the law. Let us put an end to violence and to the preaching of violence. Let the Congress pass laws to bring the insane traffic in guns to a halt.
Congress did act in a watered-down fashion. Two gun control bills were approved, but registration and licensing was not included. In Detroit, the concern was substantiated. A new record for murder, well over 400. And the killings had little pattern. They affected a variety of people. At a Detroit catering company, the owner and an employee were shot and killed by a would-be hold-up man who found there was no money to steal. A neighbor, Mrs. Barbara Miller, reacted.
A jolly old fellow. Real nice guy. Never did anything, you know, to harm anybody. That's what I can't understand. Oh, I'm going to get away from around here fast.
Cab drivers were frequent targets for hold-up men, and Detroit's council was asked to help with laws requiring bulletproof glass. Some cabbies didn't wait.
My kids have got to eat. Now, if I'm going to let some young punk come along and say, "Stick him up, give me your money," and he get out and go into the bar and spend it buying drinks, and my kids are going to go hungry. That'll never happen. Although I'll give him the money, yes. But when he get out of the cab, he's fair game to me.
In Ironwood, Michigan, a crazed janitor killed 7. And at a plush resort cabin on northern Lake Michigan, 42-year-old Richard Robison, his wife and 4 children, were found shot to death on July 22nd. They had last been seen alive on June 23rd. The entire wealthy Lathrop Village family was wiped out. There were a few clues, and the murder remained unsolved as the year ended. When the American political pace resumed, law and order and crime and control were even more the major issues, despite the growing protests for peace in Vietnam. On the Republican side, it was Richard Nixon from the very beginning, notwithstanding Nelson Rockefeller's vacillating entry into the race. The Republicans had something they had lacked before, confidence. Prior to the convention, GOP Congressman Gerald Ford optimistically and facetiously stated,
"Well, I think we'll be still far more unified, and I think we'll get behind our Republican candidate, Ronald Milhouse Percy Feller."
There were few surprises in Miami. It was Nixon on the first ballot.
8 years ago, I had the highest honor of accepting your nomination for President of the United States. But I have news for you. This time there's a difference. This time we're going to win.
Mr. Nixon's choice as running mate made more than the usual headlines. He named Maryland Governor Spiro Agnew, and there were running references to the value of a household word. With the incumbent out of the race, for the Democrats, it was expected that a man who tried before would naturally try again.
Facing and knowing the hard realities of the office, yet also knowing the potential for good which lies within it, I shall seek the nomination of the Democratic Party.
There was little doubt another Minnesotan had made his mark on the political scene. When Senator Eugene McCarthy entered the race, many laughed him off as a windmill tilter, a lackluster campaigner whose Quixote approach would amount to little. When the ballots were counted after the New Hampshire primary, the laughing stopped. McCarthy rallied the nation's youth, and if nothing else, proved the generation gap could be bridged politically. His was a campaign against an already unpopular war.
The 17 Catholic bishops of Vietnam have cried out, as they said, in the name of God, let the killing stop. And the poets and artists of Vietnam itself have said, in the name of humanity, let the killing stop. And I think the time has come for us to say, in the name of America, let the killing stop.
By the time the Democratic Convention came around in August, the entire political context of 1968 had changed beyond recognition, and there was more to come. Chicago's officials were beset from the beginning. There was a communication strike that threatened to disrupt news coverage. There were reports of an influx of anti-war and anti-establishment demonstrators. The strike proved to be a minor problem.
One cop picked up a demonstrator and tossed him into the down the steps of the subway system.
Hey, you pigs! Go run!
Here they come. They're charging into it. They're just swinging into this crowd. They're pushing the crowd. It's a stampede.
There goes a big blast of tear gas. I can't see.
The real drama of the Democratic conclave was not in Convention Hall. It was 6 miles away. There were violent clashes between police and young demonstrators. Network reporters had their troubles with police inside and out of the hall. There were charges of police brutality and Gestapo tactics. A later investigative report said police were provoked, but termed their reaction a police riot. But there was the nomination, and it was Hubert Humphrey. As a running mate, he chose Edmund Muskie, senator from Maine, and began an uphill battle made even more so by the Chicago violence. This election year, however, was not a two-way affair. There was a third-party candidate, George Corley Wallace.
President, he cannot go in safety for folks like this, and you cannot go in safety. I remember the president. Life was imperiled in the state of New York not long ago, and also in Los Angeles, California, when a group like you see here tonight lay in front of his automobile. But I want to tell you folks here in this auditorium tonight, you elect me president, and I come to Detroit or go to Los Angeles or New York City, and you lie in front of my automobile, I'm going to wean you from lying in front of automobiles. I tell you that much.
He appealed, he said, to the common man, the law-abiding citizen who worked hard and saved and was tired of rioting and violence and school busings and everything that was federalized. He chose cigar-smoking, outspoken former General Curtis LeMay for a running mate. And if nothing else, George Wallace rallies were well-attended, well-heckled, and usually afforded an outbreak between supporters and detractors.
Let the police handle it, ladies and gentlemen. Let the police handle it. Let the police handle it. Let the police handle it. Now, you fellows, let the police handle it. You came for trouble and you got it.
The main fear for many was Wallace pulling enough votes to throw the election into the House of Representatives. The vice president's campaign was constantly beset with problems, mainly noisy anti-war demonstrators. Mr. Nixon used what was best termed an antiseptic approach. And through the days from August to November, there seemed to be little real enthusiasm for any candidate. The polls proved interesting, if not accurate. The election neared, and the tabulators of America's choices came closer. There was a bombing halt, and the gap had narrowed. Defectors to Wallace came back to the Democrats, and it looked like a cliffhanger on Tuesday, November 5th. And it was. The computers and commentators could not call it. Much of America went to bed not knowing who the next president would be. Then finally, late Wednesday morning,
I have done my best. I have lost. Mr. Nixon has won. The democratic process has worked its will. So now let's get on with the urgent task of uniting our country.
And said the president-elect,
I know how it feels to lose a close one. Having lost a close one 8 years ago, and
Having won a close one this year, I can say this. Winning's a lot more fun.
The final margin was slightly over 505,000 votes, with George Wallace getting nearly 10 million. There was no mandate, and Mr. Nixon knew it.
I saw many signs in this campaign. Some of them were not friendly. Some were very friendly. But the one that touched me the most was one that I saw in Deschler, Ohio, at the end of a long day of whistle stopping. A little town, I suppose five times the population was there in the dusk. It was almost impossible to see, but a teenager held up a sign, "Bring us together." And that will be the great objective of this administration at the outset, to bring the American people together.
For Detroit, a 23-year frustration ended in 1968. It all began slowly and serenely in April and culminated unbelievably at 4:06 p.m. on October 10th. It was the year of the Tiger. Detroit's baseball team was picked as a preseason favorite, but that had happened before. This time, they lived up to expectations, winning 10 straight as the season began and leading the league for most of the summer. There were new heroes every day. Horton, Freehan, Wirt, McAuliffe, Brown, Northrop, Cash, Kaline, and McLean. Dennis McLean, a brash 24-year-old, became the sports figure of the year on Saturday, September 14th. He was the first pitcher in 34 years to win 30 games.
This is just the greatest thrill I've ever had in baseball so far. It's just the people, you could feel them with you on every pitch the whole day, you know, and when it finally happened, they went crazy out there, and I did too.
Prior to McLean's feat, Dizzy Dean had been the last to reach the magic mark. Dean was in the stands for the McLean victory.
Yeah, I was wanting to see him win it. I came all the way up here from Mississippi, 1,400 miles to see this today, and we made plans to get here, and we're here, and I got the greatest thrill I've had in a long time watching this kid today win 30 ball games in the fashion that the ball club wanted for him today.
Where there had been an occasional bumper sticker in April, by September, you weren't a true Detroiter without one. Most said, "Sock it to 'em, Tigers," and they did. With a knack for the exciting come-from-behind win that kept the fans in the ballpark for every inning. In fact, the night they won the pennant was a typical Tiger finish. WKNR's Mike O'Neill was there.
In the bottom of the ninth, the Yankees have tied this game at 1-1. Wirt is the batter. The Tigers have the bases loaded with two men out. And you can hear it. There's the run. The Tigers win 2-1 over New York here in the ninth inning, and the fans are going wild. There's confetti coming from the upper decks. They're climbing over chairs and out onto the field. It's impossible for the police to keep them back. They're just tearing across the field now, and the Tigers have won their first pennant in 23 years.
Said manager of the year, Mayo Smith.
It's a very happy day, and of course, these guys, they've played great all year. I'm happy first for them. Of course, John Fester, the Tiger organization. Last but not least, the fans. They waited a long time for this.
Did you age a little bit in that ninth inning?
No, I didn't age. I've aged all through the season, but it's been so great. These boys have just played terrific.
The Tigers and St. Louis Cards were to meet for the World Series. For the fans, everything seemed bush league compared to the October madness. They even wrote songs about it.
Tigers, Tigers, rah, rah, rah. Cardinals, Cardinals, boom, boom, boom. Tigers,
the
Tigers.
Series was billed as a battle of the pitching giants, Denny McLean and the Cards' Bob Gibson. Tiger fans had little to cheer when Gibson took charge and suddenly the Bengals had lost three of the first four games. The oddsmakers had picked the Cards and they looked correct, but Detroit wasn't that kind of team. Adversity was something you shrugged off with better pitching and key hits. They bounced back to tie it up three games each, and on the final and deciding day, it was Mickey Lolich against the previously unbeatable Bob Gibson. The Tigers did it, and Mickey Lolich was the toast of Tiger Town. Newsman Al Kosky was on the scene.
I never thought that I'd become a hero of the World Series, but I'm telling you one thing, it's great to have this feeling.
and the great pro who had waited 16 years, Al Kaline.
Well, I was very lucky. I had a good series, and I'm grateful that I could have a good series, but it's more important to win than one person to have a good series, and it was a great team effort by everybody.
For Willie Horton, there was a Santa Claus.
So many words in my heart that I like to say, but I just don't have the right word to say. I'm just happy, and it's just like Christmas came early.
And an entire city went mad. It was New Year's Eve, the 4th of July, Halloween, V.E. Day, and the Mardi Gras all rolled into one. Strangers kissed, horns blared, confetti and streamers spewed from office buildings. Thousands of fans headed for Metropolitan Airport to welcome their heroes home. The crowd spilled onto runways, closing the airport and diverting the champion's plane to Willow Run. But no one really cared. It was everyone's celebration.
I've been in that pond already.
Anything that ever happened in our life. It's great. It looks like New Year's Eve in the middle of the day.
We're going around Lolich for mayor.
I think it's just positively fantastic to look out of the window out of the federal building, see all the black and the white hugging onto each other. I just wish this could go on and on forever.
Detroiters who wanted to read about the Tigers' road toward a championship had problems for most of the baseball season. There were no regular daily newspapers. The Free Press and News had been closed down for a month and a half when 1968 began. A strike darkened the news, and the Free Press closed under a publisher's agreement. It was to be a long time before either paper printed again. There were interim papers, called by some the Vulture Press. The last of these folded in early 68, and as it did, there were accusations by some of the state's lawmakers that possible labor racketeering may have been involved. Some members of the striking Teamsters had been involved in the operation of the strike papers. State Senator Robert Huber headed a special subcommittee probing the strike, and after hearing some testimony, he noted,
"It certainly is obvious, gentlemen, from the testimony that's come before this committee that there is a real cauldron boiling here, and it has been going on for some time, and we want it all spread out where everybody can see it."
The hearings did little to help end the strike. Mayor Kavanaugh called in a noted arbitrator, Dr. Nathan Feinsinger from the University of Wisconsin. He became the colorful central figure in talks to end the paper blackout. Dr. Feinsinger, although aging and suffering from Parkinson's disease, was the major force in getting talks started and keeping them going. And, at least publicly, he remained optimistic.
"I am very satisfied with the progress made in these last few days."
"Are you a little disappointed that you weren't able to completely wrap the thing up by tonight?"
No. All I wanted was to get an agreement, and if we couldn't get an agreement, get as close as we could to an agreement so that we could focus next week on the remaining issues. And I'm not at all unhappy about the way things stand right now. And I would confidently predict that we will reach an agreement sometime with the
In mid-June, intensive talks resulted in a public midnight meeting with Dr. Feinsinger unveiling his recommendations for a settlement. The publishers agreed, the union said no, but it was the beginning of the end. And most unions came to terms in July, and finally on August 9th, the nation's longest newspaper strike was over. After 268 days, the Detroit News and Free Press were back in business, and everyone seemed happy.
"Are you glad to be back at work?"
"Sure am.
Glad to be back on the truck?"
"It's beautiful to be back, I'll tell you. It's been a long, long time."
"How's that paper look to you?"
"Very nice, very nice, I'll tell you."
"How about you, glad to be back?"
"No, you know it."
In the early months of 1968, there was a lot of talk about stop and frisk, permitting police to stop what they considered to be a suspicious person and search them for possible weapons. There was a question of constitutionality. Many Detroit suburbs passed such laws, including Dearborn, where city attorney Ralph Guy Jr. noted,
"Well, I think here we avoid the issue that's been raised in so many communities that this is aimed at a Negro minority. Since we are basically an all-white community, obviously, the law here will be enforced against whites, and I think it would be a good trial area to show that stop and frisk can work and that it's not, in fact, aimed at any minority group."
In Detroit, it was a testy subject. Councilman Philip Van Antwerp proposed such an ordinance and was outspoken in doing so.
I'm getting just a little bit tired of these long, hot summers. I think that there are many, many fine Negroes in this town, and I don't think we're going to have long, hot summers because some of these Negro leaders better watch their step, because they're getting to a point now where they're threatening people and people are getting fed up with it.
Council finally okayed stop and frisk. The Supreme Court upheld such laws, and police were legally authorized to do what many admitted they'd been doing all along anyway. 1968 saw two new law enforcement officials in the metropolitan area as Commissioner of Police Johannes Spreen, an imposingly big man with a background of 20 years in New York's finest. As
we see it, there are two major problems in police work. One is the crime problem and its reduction, which is very important. And secondly, it's the problem of community tensions. Police work should not aggravate community tensions, but should be done in such a way as to lessen them.
The new commissioner was a big man with a big job that afforded many problems during the year. When Peter Buback resigned under fire as Wayne County Sheriff, there was considerable speculation as to his successor. It was all wrong. The man named was virtually unknown, Roman S. Gribbs, an attorney with a background as traffic court referee.
The first step is to get the men to work together, because everything follows from that. If they can work as a police force should work, and I expect that they will, then we can get the community to recognize our responsibilities and to assist us in the programs that must be done.
At year's end, Sheriff Gribbs had been elected to the office and had made some giant steps in rebuilding the department. But all was not serene with the boys in blue. They made some headlines of the wrong kind. In May, when a contingent of the Poor People's Marchers held a Detroit rally, an incident ensued. Outside Cobo Hall, police were accused of charging in to some of the marchers in a dispute over a parked car. The marchers called it an unprovoked attack.
The police attacked everybody out there senselessly on those horsebacks, swinging those clubs around. They shoved their billy club right in the groin of one of the ministers out there. Beat us on the inside, and then the cops on the inside pushed us outside. The cops on the outside pushed everybody on the inside over nothing, trying to tow away a car out there that we needed because it was parked out here for 2 minutes.
Was anybody injured seriously, Father?
We got a commando here with his head split open.
A subsequent investigation led to some suspensions and later disciplinary action. In November, the police again were accused of some wrongdoing. This time, it was a case of off-duty officers attending a dance at the Veterans Memorial Building. In the same building, a group of Negro teens were holding another dance. The youngsters said they were attacked and were beaten by police. Councilman Nicholas Hood said his sons were there.
My own teenage sons were there, and the younger one went out to get some water. They were playing in the combo, but he went out to get some water, and at that time, some men closed in around him and made some derogatory statements, and he had to run to get away from them. So the tension was very high there all evening between the youth and the adults.
And Mayor Kavanaugh was obviously disturbed.
But we know, and I don't kid myself, that if what happened did in fact happen, it happened because they were black and not white.
Again, an investigation. Again, more suspensions, and in this case, two officers facing criminal charges. As the year ended, yet another officer was accused of beating a Negro youth. He, too, suspended after Congressman John Conyers called for the removal of what he termed racists from the ranks of Detroit's police. In Highland Park, 10 officers and 3 former policemen faced some serious charges, ranging from conspiracy to burglary to abortion. The men were indicted by a grand jury based on information supplied by 4 former Highland Park police officers, themselves in prison following robbery convictions. For all of the problems, law enforcement had its better moments. 1968 brought an increase in efforts against organized crime. Michigan's Attorney General Frank Kelly set up a special division to combat the so-called organization. As a result, there were a large number of arrests, including 13 Detroit area men, some alleged mafia chiefs, on loan sharking and weapons charges. One of them, Vito Billy Jack Jackalone. For the first time in his checkered career, he went to jail, convicted of possessing a blackjack. Circuit Judge Victor Baum wasted few words in handing down a 5-year jail term.
It is naive to think that a sentence of probation would rehabilitate a middle-aged man for whom crime has been a successful way of life. Probation is simply not going to work with a 45-year-old man who has lived most of his life in luxury outside the law.
There was also concern about motorcyclists. Attorney General Kelly called for a crackdown.
We've received reports from law enforcement officials of a series of rapes, kidnappings, beatings, and other vicious attacks on our citizenry. Citizens have complained of being surrounded on the highways while driving their car and being threatened or abused by phalanxes of motorcycles. One disturbing sign has been the use of terror by some of the individuals through the wearing of tire chains, brass knuckles, and hunting knives on their uniforms.
The continuing controversy over police and law enforcement constantly brought up the difficulty in the courts. As Michigan State Police Colonel Frederick Davids noted,
must remember that an arrest for the violation is not the end of the case. And I think that if you were to look at the record, you will find that many thousands of arrests are made each year. But then if you take a further look at the record at what the disposition of the cases are, you might be alarmed.
The rising use of drugs by youngsters brought a call for a solution. How bad was the dope problem? In terms of percentages, Wayne State University's Dr. Herbert Raskin explained.
As far as we've been able to determine, and these are different surveys throughout various aspects of the country, the range is from zero in some of the rural areas upwards to 35-40% in some of the urban high schools and colleges.
Much of the narcotic problem seemed based in Detroit's so-called hippie community. It was there, too, where detectives concentrated their search as a series of bombings hit the region. The targets, police cars, recruiting offices, a draft board, and a CIA office near the University of Michigan. There appeared to be a pattern, and Detroit's Commissioner Spreen put two and two together.
Perhaps it's not entirely directed at the police or so, that it might be sort of, from what we can see, maybe sort of just anti-establishment.
Late in the year, 19 warrants were issued charging several youngsters, including some reputed hippie leaders. Fair housing became a reality in Michigan during 1968. A dozen communities passed their own ordinances, and statewide, the legislature acted. That wide-ranging citizens committee formed after the riots of 1967 incorporated and became a permanent entity. But New Detroit had problems. There were those in the Negro community for whom self-determination was most important. Among them, Reverend Albert Clegg.
If they had insisted that we work with Mickey Mouse, it would have been the same thing. They can't tell us who to work with or how to work or where to work or what to do. We believe in self-determination for the black community. Nobody can tell us what to do. And if they think they can, we just can't, you know, can't even talk with them any longer because they don't understand. They're living in a yesteryear that's past. The plantation is now out of fashion. They just have to learn it, that's all.
Despite the withdrawal of some Negro members, New Detroit continued to help and heal in the rebuilding process, and a 1-year progress report showed there had been just that. Industry and business pitched in to help solve the difficulties of the hardcore unemployed. Henry Ford II headed up the drive.
Oh, the business community has been receptive, fantastically receptive.
Ford made other news, perhaps the biggest business story of the year. Seaman Hudson left General Motors to join the Ford Motor Company as president. History had made the cycle. Hudson's father had left Ford to join GM and later become its president. Now the defection was reversed. The auto industry itself moved along in high gear. Sales were never better. And for the first time in a long time, American Motors showed a spectacular turnabout, announcing a profit. In the spring, 50,000 people moved into Washington. It was the Poor People's March. They built what was called Resurrection City in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial. They wanted more understanding and more help for the nation's poor. Many Detroiters were there. At least one, Mrs. Josephine Smith, didn't stay too long and didn't like it while she did.
It was the biggest farce ever hit this country, that Poor People's Campaign. There's old people, 75 and 80 years old, about a dozen or so. They're laying around sick because I have to take food to some of these people because they were too weak and sick to walk to the tent where the food was served. And the food wasn't fitting for dogs to eat. We didn't have anything decent to eat. Oh, yes, and at night, These guys, all day long they would get drunk, but then at night they would start to perform and they would fight. It was just a big holy mess, and they should get those people out of Washington.
The poor people proved little, and their city of shacks came down in front of bulldozers as most quietly left the Capitol. President Johnson ran into some unexpected and strong opposition when he nominated Justice Abe Fortas for the Supreme Court's top spot. Earl Warren had announced plans to retire. The president wanted Fortas to move up and another old friend, Homer Thornberry, to replace Fortas. Michigan Senator Robert Griffin had other ideas.
I wonder, for example, if Mr. Fortas would have been appointed if he had not been the attorney for Bobby Baker, if he had not been the attorney throughout Mr. Johnson's public career, his personal attorney, if Mr. Thornberry hadn't been one of his closest personal friends from Texas. And the question is whether or not we're going to condone cronyism.
Griffin engineered a Senate filibuster, and Justice Fortas stepped aside. George Romney is finally going to Washington. He was among the new cabinet named by the president-elect.
When I think of the post of housing and urban development, I think, as I'm sure everybody listening to me first will think of, the necessity for an administrator, because it's a big department. A lot of money is spent there. And Governor George Romney meets that test, both as a business executive with remarkable success and as governor of the state of Michigan.
And as the state gained a cabinet member, there would be a new governor. William Milliken, hard-working Traverse City resident who had served in the legislature and then as lieutenant governor.
In the coming weeks, I expect to spell out very clearly the objectives of my administration and to seek public and legislative support in achieving these objectives.
In July, there was a papal encyclical. Pope Paul reaffirmed the ban on artificial birth control. Many laymen and even some priests disputed the ruling. Detroit's liberal Archbishop John Dearden was reluctant but firm.
We are aware of the difficulties that this teaching lays upon so many of our conscientious married people. But we must face the reality that struggling to live out the will of God often entails sacrifice.
Heart transplants came to Michigan. In September, a 49-year-old Kalamazoo accountant, Philip Barnum, received a new heart at the University of Michigan. 3 months later, Barnum went home.
It's been a long journey, but I'm more than happy to be here today, gentlemen.
Later, Donald Kaminsky of Alpena became the state's second heart transplant patient. He continues to make progress. As in any year, there were many who left for good. Among them, Lurleen Wallace, Helen Keller, Upton Sinclair, Peter Arno, Fanny Hurst and Edna Ferber, Joe Martin and husband Kimmel, Laverne Andrews and Tallulah Bankhead, Dr. Charles Mayo, Edwin O'Connor, Raymond Navarro and French Autone, Dan Duryea, Norman Thomas and John Steinbeck, Wilbur Brucker and John Dancy, Dr. Carl Bart, Thomas Merton, Roy Ruther, Ty Tyson and Jack Adams, Charles Bickford, Lee Tracy, Fred Clark, and John Nance Garner. And there were other deaths, nameless and tragic. 12,000 in Iranian earthquakes, hundreds in air crashes, and thousands on the nation's highways. The nuclear sub Scorpion disappeared off the Azores. 99 were aboard. In Richmond, Indiana, an April explosion killed 43. And at Mannington, West Virginia, 78 miners were entombed by a series of explosions and fires. Teachers and students were at the forefront in 68. The worst teacher walkouts came in Florida and New York. Michigan did not escape. The longest walkout came in the downriver community of Gibraltar, where an uneasy truce put the kids back in the classrooms when they normally would have been on Christmas vacation. From Pomona to Paris to Peking, there were students who tried to change the world. The worst was at the Sorbonne, at Columbia, in Mexico City, and at San Francisco State. They rebelled on issues ranging from cafeteria food to academic reform to the very foundations of society itself. In suburban Highland Park, community college students joined the ranks of protesters. Theirs was a peaceful approach, and the city's mayor, Robert Blackwell, found little reason to argue.
One demand I heard was that they wanted doors on the men's john. I don't know whether this is an appropriate demand, but it seems to be appropriate to me. You ought to have some privacy somewhere.
1968 recorded many other events. The 82 surviving crewmen of the USS Pueblo were freed by North Korea after 11 months. They had a happy holiday homecoming. There were skyjackings. Many Miami-bound airliners flew on to Havana. There was a November defeat for daylight time in Michigan, and a recount began. There was the Manoogian Mansion, which the mayor called home while council kibitzed. There was a lot of talk about parochade and some other financial and education concerns. There was a Detroit income tax that doubled. There was a surcharge. There was Czechoslovakia, where coexistence died. The Olympics satisfied Americans, and so did O.J. Simpson, but Ohio State was number one. Bump Elliott moved up, and Bo Schembechler moved in. Roberto DiFizenzo had signature problems. Bobby Unser and Cale Yarborough drove to victory. Jimmy Clark drove the final lap. Boxing remained a mess, while the Derby was marred when Dancer's Image won on Saturday and lost on Tuesday. The Canadiens stayed on top, and so did Green Bay. But for them, an era ended. For the Lions, it hadn't begun. Gordie Howe slammed in his 700th. DeBuscher moved on, and Seymour moved in. There was no progress in Paris as the war went on. Abrams replaced Westmoreland, Clifford, McNamara. There was a Detroiter named Dwight Johnson and a Medal of Honor. There was a crisis in gold and a boomerang for De Gaulle. There were two queens in America, Elizabeth and Mary. There was starvation in Biafra, an ex-president in Walter Reed. There was Hong Kong flu and some sick Americans. There was Heidi yodeling while the fans fumed. There was a show called Hair and the resurrection of Bonnie and Clyde. There was a faith healer named Agpow, a trustee named May, some bubbling earth in Calhoun County. There was a dispute over an anthem as offered by a singer named Feliciano. There was a divorce for the UAW and two weddings of note. Jackie Kennedy became Jackie Onassis, and a Nixon and Eisenhower were united. And so it went in 68. An incredible year in an incredible age. There were many things we would change, but we can't. Those who live through this time will remember. Remember when they kept silent and when they spoke out. When they mourned, when they wept, and when they laughed. Others may listen and wonder. For WKNR News, this is Philip Nye. We'll be right back.